From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. William Crystal is one of the most influential political thinkers in America today, the most prominent voice of the neoconservative movement. He led the rallying cry to topple Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and he continues to influence Bush-era policy from his offices at the Weekly Standard magazine. Tonight on Point, Weekly Standard editor William Crystal and the neoconservative experiment so far. But first, we begin tonight in London with the latest on the investigation into last week's deadly bombing that killed at least 52. Surprising developments today point to the work of four suicide bombers. This morning, British police went to Leeds in northern England and searched the homes of three of the suspects. Rob Watson is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. I asked him to describe what British police uncovered in their investigation today.
Well, indeed, truly dramatic breakthroughs and dramatic events in this investigation. Put most basically, it's a nightmare for the British government, because what the British police, what the investigators believe they've discovered, is that this was indeed a suicide attack involving four bombers who were British-born. Now, that would be the first case of a homegrown suicide attack in Britain, so very, 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 very worrying indeed for the government. They're not absolutely sure that all four of them died. They're pretty sure that three of them died in the attacks, but they still have some forensic and other work to do to confirm that.
Rob, what's the evidence that has led to this conclusion?
Well, there's a lot of evidence. In the first place, it is forensic. They believe that tests done at the explosion site show that at least one of the bombers died on one train. They have also found what they call personal property with names attached on one of the other trains and also on the bus that exploded. Now, added to that, they had received a call from the family of one of the men who they believe was one of the attackers, saying that he was missing. And on top of that, they've also seen closed-circuit television pictures of the four men together at King's Cross Station just before all the attacks were unleashed.
So at this point, how many of the four are believed to have died? How many are known to have died? What's the death count there? All of them? Some of them?
They're not absolutely certain about any of them, but they're pretty certain, if I could put it that way, that three of the four are dead. And they believe that the other one probably died, but they're just not sure, because the site at which he may have died, the bomb that was between King's Cross Station and Russell Square, is just so far down. But I think they're working under the thesis that all four of them died.
What did the raids in the northern city of Leeds reveal today, and why there, and what came out of that?
Well, they went to Leeds because that was where they believed that at least three of the four bombers were from. They were dawn raids. They visited six homes, including three of the homes believed to be the homes of the suspected bombers. And what they say they found so far was some explosives. They haven't said any more about what kind of explosives. And they also made an arrest in Leeds, and the arrest was of someone who was a relative of one of the suspected bombers. I should say that closer to London, in a town called Luton, which is about, I don't know, 30 miles north of London at a railway station, they found a car which they believe is connected to the attacks, and the police say that in that car they also found explosives.
So just days after the attacks, we now see what you describe as a nightmare scenario for the British government, homegrown suicide attacks. What are the implications for the UK?
Well, there are so many, but before I get to that, one should quickly say that although there have been dramatic breakthroughs, there's still an awful lot more that the police need to do. Most importantly, they need to find out, did they have any other support from either inside or outside the country? But in terms of the implications of it, if indeed, as it looks, it turns out to be British suicide bombers attacking British targets, then clearly the government has to be very worried about intercommunal relations. There are about 2 million Muslims living in Britain, and the British government is extremely worried that they may be the subject of a backlash. I think that the British government will also be concerned about how you stop young Muslims in this country from becoming radicalized like this. And I think that the British government may also, or in particular the intelligence services, face questions of, well, if these people were living here in Britain, how did we miss them?
Rob, if I may change gears for just a moment, a memo out of the UK purportedly suggesting that the UK is preparing to pull down its troop level in Iraq, perhaps dramatically, by the end of this year or sometime next year. What do you know about that?
Well, it was a memo that was written by a very senior policy director at the Ministry of Defence. It was also signed off by the Secretary of State for Defence in this country, so there's no way of dismissing it just purely as a little thinky paper, the kind of thing that civil servants do. That said, that the British government is insisting, look, our policy has not changed, but this document does talk about moving troops, quite a large number of troops, out of Iraq, British troops, and says that the United States is eager to do the same. Now, again, one might say this isn't that controversial. Of course, at some point, the British and American governments need to think about when the time will come when they want to draw down their troops. But of course, it's caused something of a fuss, although one might add that, you know, that given that a lot of people will say maybe these attacks in London were connected to British policy in Iraq, this would hardly be the time for the British government to be seen as giving in any way and removing troops from Iraq.
What about that? The Spanish, of course, famously pulled out of Iraq after the attacks on Madrid. Do you think that these bombings in London make it more or less likely that the goal outlined in that memo will be pursued, that is, of pullout?
Two-word answer, less likely.
Rob Watson, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Rob Watson is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. He spoke with us from London. William Crystal sits at the nexus of politics and policy in George W. Bush's America. As editor of the Weekly Standard and perhaps the most prominent neoconservative in the country, he is a force. From the Supreme Court to the war in Iraq, Crystal wants to see the United States moving to the right and acting from the right. And on almost every front, he has succeeded. His vision for the Middle East is hardly discernible from Bush policy. He called loudly for the war in Iraq and got it. Now he quotes Winston Churchill to say, "Push on to victory, whatever the cost, in the global war on terror." George Bush is in his fifth year as president. This should be William Crystal's moment. Tonight on Point, William Crystal and the successes and failures of the neocon agenda. You can join the conversation tonight. What's your question for the country's most prominent neoconservative intellectual? What's your question for the man who led the neocon campaign for war with Iraq? Is the neocon understanding of the world being borne out by events? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Bill Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard and chairman and co-founder of the neoconservative think tank Project for the New American Century. Bill Crystal, wonderful to have you. Thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Bill.
Bill, hi, Jack.
Bill Crystal, much we want to get to with you tonight, but I guess we have to go straight to the headlines. First, Karl Rove has got all kinds of hot water around this evening. What do you think the president ought to do with him?
I guess he has to discover what the truth is about who leaked what, and I think this is ultimately going to be resolved by Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, not by, random emails being released or leaked by particular journalists. I have no idea who did what, frankly, and I don't think any of us really does. But, you know, it's a serious legal investigation. A grand jury's been convened. People have been put under oath. Phone records and emails have been subpoenaed. That's a serious thing, and people could be indicted, and people could be forced to resign, obviously.
Obviously, and lots of investigation going on there. Do you think that this case should be decided on the tight legal merits of what's found? Or, you know, even if Karl Rove came close to breaking the law but didn't, should he go?
It depends on what he did. I mean, I'd say the one thing we know, the email, Matt Cooper's account and his email to his editor of his conversation with Rove, which was a 2-minute conversation that Cooper initiated, mm-hmm. the last 30 seconds of which was about this Joe Wilson op-ed that had appeared, and Rove's obviously trying to minimize its impact and discredit it and says, well, you know, he went there because his wife's in the CIA. We don't know whether that was, you know, whether Rove was entitled to know that or not, whether he thought he was breaking a law by saying that. I don't think we know enough now. I don't feel like I know enough now to say that Karl Rove deserves to be fired. But I don't minimize the seriousness of this. I think people are focused on Rove. My own guess, and it's purely a guess, is that it will turn out that other people, perhaps in the administration, who were more centrally involved in foreign policy, may be in more trouble than Rove. But honestly, who knows?
Mm. And with a couple of minutes before our first break here, Bill, let's turn to the Supreme Court for a moment. President Bush hosting a breakfast this morning with Republican and Democratic Party Senate leaders. What kind of track do you see that whole process on right now?
Well, the president's going to fill at least one vacancy and maybe two 2 weeks from now. I'm told that he intends to make a nomination or two if Chief Justice Rehnquist resigns in the next few days, the week of July 25th, I think it is, the last week of July, before the Senate goes out in August, before the president goes to Crawford, Texas for his 110-degree vacation idyll down there. I have said before that the president really wants to nominate his Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez. There's a big struggle going on as to whether to persuade the president not to do that. Some people trying to persuade him to do it.
You're against Gonzalez. Why, Bill Kristol?
Well, because I would prefer someone who I think would be a justice more in the spirit of Scalia and Thomas, and there are plenty of good appellate court judges, plenty of good state Supreme Court judges, male and female, white, Hispanic, black, whatever, who have a proven track record in that way, which Gonzalez doesn't. So I'd prefer to see many other people nominated before Gonzalez. I also think he's just been Attorney General a few months, and it would be a little odd to pull him out of that important job to put him on the court.
We're talking tonight with Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, leading neoconservative thinker and chief proponent of the Iraq War. We're going to talk about that after a break. You can join us. What's your question for the country's most prominent neoconservative intellectual? What's your question for the man who led the neocon campaign for war with Iraq? Is the neocon understanding of the world being borne out by events? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, leading neoconservative thinker. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it time for Bill Kristol to eat crow on Iraq, or time for all Americans to buckle down there and beyond for the long haul? Did Bill Kristol help lead us into the right war in Iraq, globally? And 4.5 years into the Bush era, what's your assessment of how the neocon experiment is going? Are we safer? Are we headed toward a better world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bill Kristol, you're writing today in the Weekly Standard after the attacks on London, quoting Winston Churchill right off the bat, saying, "You ask what is our policy? I will say it is to wage war." Churchill's words, to go for victory, victory at all costs, victory in spite of all terror, victory however long and hard the road may be. What's your message post-London?
Well, a perfectly simple one, that you can't buckle to terror, and I don't think that's a very controversial message. You cannot let terrorists feel that they are succeeding in their acts of terror, that they succeed in influencing policy or intimidating governments or nations. And I think that was a mistake we made in the 90s and 80s. We were driven out of Lebanon by terror. We were driven out of Somalia by terror. Osama bin Laden was very clear in the lessons he took from that. And I think we cannot buckle to terror.
And when you look at Iraq today, the casualty level, military and civilian there, the situation on the ground, the reports day after day of suicide bombings, and all the rest, reports of terrorists being trained there, inspired by the conflict there, what does it leave you thinking on your original support for the war?
I think it was the right war. I think it's been incompetently executed in certain ways, and certainly the terrorist threat there today, I mean, the terrorist attacks there today are worse than I would have expected, I think partly because of failures on our part. On the other hand, I'm optimistic about the Middle East. I'm optimistic about the political situation in Iraq. I'm optimistic about the spillover effects of the Iraq war. And I think we will end up being safer because of having gone in to remove Saddam and having begun to change the dynamics of dictatorship and terror in the Middle East.
Jack Beatty, we've had conversations, every 6 or 9 months with Bill Kristol since 9/11, since this show began. A lot of history passed between those conversations. Here we are tonight with the situation in Iraq, beyond London, in the U.S. Your questions, your thoughts for this very important neocon thought leader in Washington.
Well, you know, when you say harsh things, you always have to stipulate that in this case, Bill Kristol is an American patriot. He wants only the best for the country. That said, over the portal of the Weekly Standard, there should appear W.H. Auden's line, "Intellectual disgrace stares from every human face." You know, the things that have happened in Iraq were foreseeable and foreseen by the critics of this venture. The terrorism locally that would hit our troops, foreseen. The stimulation of international terrorism and recruiting, foreseen. The nationalist insurgency, or Sunni insurgency, foreseen. The open-ended financial, leave aside the human cost, foreseen as against what Paul Wolfowitz said, that it would pay for itself, that Iraq's oil would pay for itself. The alienation of world opinion, foreseen, of Arab opinion, just when we needed to win friends in the Arab world, foreseen. And the strengthening of the position of Iran relative to Iraq, foreseen, predicted because of the Shiite dominance in Iraq. You know, all of this was predicted, all of this was foreseen, and yet Bill and his colleagues, in a kind of millennialist fervor, just waved it all away and said, no, we can make, our power can make almost anything happen, and none of those problems, even if they arise, are going to impede this great effort we want to mount on behalf of democracy in the Middle East.
Bill Kristol, that's a long bill of particulars. I'm sure you'll push it away, but are there nights when you wake up wondering about some of those particulars?
Sure. And there are days that I've written editorials very critical of Don Rumsfeld and of the Bush administration's conduct of the war. But I think what Jack says is hogwash, just hogwash. I mean, do we not balance the, I mean, does the liberation of the Iraqi people from Saddam count for nothing? Does Jack think that it's inappropriate for the majority Shia in Iraq to rule Iraq in a democratic system? Do the moves towards democracy in the rest of the Middle East count for nothing? There's no evidence that there's been a stimulation of terrorism around the world. Arab public opinion, the Arab street, hasn't rallied against the U.S. or against America, governments friendly to us. It's rallied for democracy.
We have
dead Syrian government.
Dead in the subways of Boston, London, we're told, by homegrown terrorists tonight. We have CIA report warning of the fear of terrorists being trained, provoked, inspired out of Iraq.
And there were no dead in New York City on 9/11, and there were no terrorist attacks in Europe before we went into Iraq. The demand was, of course, to get out of Iraq and Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden's terrorist recruiting camps, were they before Iraq or after Iraq?
Clearly before, but now we're hearing, we see the Navy SEALs brought down along the Pakistani border and talk of a Taliban and Al-Qaeda resurgent in Afghanistan
as well.
So is
the anti-war position that we should be pulling out of Afghanistan or should not have gone in there or should not have stayed and tried to help Karzai create a democracy?
Let me not speak for that position.
I mean, seriously, what is the implication of saying that Navy SEALs were shot down near the border, that we shouldn't be in Afghanistan?
Well, let me ask you on the front of execution. Is there a point at which execution of these operations falls so far short of what you might have envisioned that it leads you to begin to think again about the limits of U.S. strength to carry out that vision?
Sure, but and I have friends who voted for Kerry on that grounds. They were supporters of the war, and they thought that a Kerry administration would carry it out better than a Bush administration. I think the U.S. is capable of carrying out, I wouldn't even call it a vision, but I think the fundamental tasks of removing two dictatorships and helping other countries in the Middle East move towards liberalization and towards democracy. We could do it with less cost. We could do it, unfortunately, and sometimes we have to do it with more cost. But I don't think this is beyond our power, and I think we will prevail, incidentally. I think we will prevail.
Jack Beatty, you hear Bill Kristol. He says hogwash in response to the bill of particulars. He describes kind of uneven, imperfect progress, but progress. You describe a kind of trend toward, I don't know, Armageddon. What do you say?
Well, I quote Senator Hegel, the reality is that we're losing in Iraq. I cite the latest poll, which shows for the first time that a plurality of Americans, a majority of Americans, now see Iraq as separate from the war on terror and see it indeed as harming the war on terror. I cite Richard Clark, who said at times in the Bush White House, he felt that the president was, quote, channeling Osama bin Laden in his fateful will to invade Iraq. You know, I think we just have to wake up to the reality here that yes, we do have the enemy with Osama bin Laden and radical Islam, but that wasn't the enemy we attacked in Baghdad. That was a diversion from this. I quite agree with Bill. That really deadly conflict, and it has done nothing, it seems to me, and it seems to people who know a lot more than I do, but hurt us in that endeavor.
Bill Kristol, is there a margin of error in the path that that you, among others, have helped us get on here in Iraq that leads you in a cold sweat? I mean, you paint the picture of this going well over a long time and delivering great results. But what about a margin of error that leans in a different direction? Does the margin of error you imagine come anywhere close to what Jack Beattie seems to fear?
Look, I mean, policies can go wrong, and those of us who've advocated policies obviously worry when they go wrong or that they'll go wrong and have to take responsibility for that. But the fair way to take responsibility, obviously, is to contrast it with the real-world alternatives. And, you know, we should then have a serious talk at some point about what the Middle East would look like with Saddam still in power, the inspectors gone, the sanctions off, our troops withdrawn, or maybe leaving troops in Saudi Arabia if people think that was such a wonderful stimulation to Arab moderation and if people think that didn't help Osama recruit terrorists. And let's have a serious talk about whether that world is more or less dangerous than the world we live in now. So, I mean, that's the real world to govern us to choose. And I will defend the basic choices the Bush administration has made over the last 3.5 years.
And the key dangers, to your mind, of what that world might have looked like without the Iraq War?
Oh, I think Saddam reconstituting his weapons, radicalism triumphant in the Middle East, any hope of liberalization, democratization in Lebanon and Egypt, any sense among the peoples of the Middle East that they have a way out of this nightmare choice between dictatorship and radical Islam, I think there would have been none of that. We would be in retreat. Maybe we'd still be in Afghanistan fighting there. I'm not so sure. I think radicals and terrorists would have been strengthened all over the world by the perception of American weakness.
And now when you quote Winston Churchill, wage war with all our might, victory at all costs, where do you think this is going? Do you see this? I mean, it's been a nasty ride in Iraq. I guess everybody has to agree at this point. Do you see this veering back onto some more manageable path, or are we headed towards some kind of great cataclysmic global conflict here, a kind of Armageddon? And if it comes to that, if that's what it takes, let's go there.
No, we're not headed towards some kinds of Armageddon. Come on, let's have a grown-up discussion. It's unfortunate that we have the casualties we have in Iraq. Is the Middle East blowing up all around us? Are we in a war suffering tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of casualties? There have been two attacks. There's been no attack since 9/11 in the U.S. There's been one attack in Madrid, one attack in London, a couple of attacks in Istanbul, a very bad attack in Bali, and then several other attacks in Riyadh and countries like that. That's the terror threat. It's manageable. We can deal with it. We should deal with it aggressively. And that's all I was saying by quoting Churchill. And in Iraq, we have a very tough occupation, but we're handling it. We don't need to. We're not heading towards Armageddon. We're not heading towards a meltdown. We're heading towards improvement, I trust, in the situation on the ground there. And I think making progress in neighboring nations. We still have very tough challenges, obviously, in other places in the world, but those would be there whether or not we were in Iraq. So I'm moderately optimistic. I don't think we should oversell the future. I think I've tried not to, and I think Bush, to his credit, has always said it would be tough and it would be hard. And we shouldn't make it seem either as if we're heading towards Armageddon or as if we're heading towards paradise.
Donald Rumsfeld has also said it would be tough and it would be hard. You've been very critical of him. Can you reach whatever success you envision with him as Secretary of Defense?
I think so. I really think it would have been a good idea for the president to replace him in December, and I don't think I'm scapegoating him. I mean, these were real debates in real time about troop levels and about allowing the looting to begin in Iraq, and he made fundamentally wrong judgments there. And I would have liked the president to have held him accountable, as I say, not in a scapegoating way, but I think it would be better with a different Secretary of Defense. Having said that, we are a very strong country. We have an awfully good military. Most of the Iraqi people want a decent Iraq. They don't want the terrorists to win. Even most of the Sunnis don't want the terrorists to win. And I think we'll be okay, actually, in Iraq, but it's just a little tougher than certainly any of us hoped.
I want to begin to bring our callers in. Marianne is calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Marianne, you're on the air. Your question for Bill Kristol.
When I hear you quote Churchill saying war at all costs, my question is whether this includes some personal costs for the neocons. Many of them supported the war in Vietnam, yet none of them served. My brother did, and that included, his service included 77 days at the siege of Khe Sanh. 37 years later, when these neocons started the war in Iraq, I'm not aware of any of their children who are serving in that country. Yet my brother's eldest son was ordered into Iraq. When I hear Governor Pataki talk about wanting to get a deferment of 3 years so that his son can attend law school, I'm reminded of the Republicans and the neocons of the 60s, for example, the Bushes, who managed to get out of serving in a war that they supported. And this goes beyond just, you know, serving in the military for their children. What about the financial costs? Are they willing to give up their tax breaks in order to support this?
Marianne, we've got it. Bill Kristol, you know this line of critique, and I wonder, as the strain on the Army has grown deeper, if it's more painful to hear it.
No, I mean, I do happen to have the sons and daughters of friends of mine who have fought in Iraq and one who's going off to Iraq in 2 weeks. John McCain is the man I supported for president in 2000, and he fought in Vietnam, and he supports the Iraq war. Look, the war is either good policy or bad policy, and, you know, the fact that George Bush didn't serve, or that, you know, John Edwards was too young to serve, or Hillary Clinton was a woman, I mean, none of that makes any difference. Either it's a sensible, either it's good for the country or it's not.
You're not worried about who's fighting the war as it goes on, as we hear the possibility of it going on to 2012. I mean, that's a long time. The ranks are thin. And you know who overwhelmingly populates those ranks. It's not the sons and daughters of your friends in Washington mine in Boston, overwhelmingly.
That's not so true, incidentally. I mean, if we can just have an empirical discussion here. The Army is fairly representative of the country as it happens. The Marines even more so, and they're obviously taking the worst casualties.
If you speak racially, that's true, but if you speak economically, from all the figures I've seen, it's not so true at all.
Well, it's probably disproportionately towards the working class and towards the lower middle class, but it's a volunteer army. I've been for increasing the size of the army, and I myself am open to a draft. I mean, I've always thought that was a reasonable policy for this country. The military doesn't want it. It's awfully, they get too many people, and it's expensive to train them, and they leave after 2 years, et cetera. So there's a practical question about whether a universal draft is a good idea, and we know what happened in Vietnam with a kind of non-universal draft. So I think a volunteer army makes sense. If it's a volunteer army, you can't compel people to go into it. But I'm proud of the people, young people I know who are going in. And I don't know what I can say except that I obviously respect very much those who are serving in the military.
And what about the financial costs? Marianne asks if it's time to take back the tax cuts to help pay for the war. You've pushed in just the opposite direction, saying President Bush celebrate those tax cuts and make them permanent.
I think you know, the best way to pay for the war is to have a good economy. Bush's tax cuts, I think, have produced pretty good economic growth in this country, 3.5-4% over the last 2-3 years, a lot faster than those countries in Western Europe that chose not to cut taxes when we went into the recession. So I think we could argue about the exact composition of the tax cuts and whether a couple of years from now we'll have to perhaps adjust them, and I wouldn't object to that, obviously. Defense comes first. The needs of the military and of our fundamental national interests come first. But for now, I actually think Bush's economic policies are somewhat vindicated. Our economy is in pretty good shape. We have 5% unemployment.
Jack Beatty, Bill Kristol essentially sort of saying, let's put our heads down and steady as she goes. Never mind your list of criticisms here. Essentially on the right track and going to stay on it.
Yeah, well, our caller was raising the issue of sacrifice, you know, empirical fact. This is the first war for which Americans have not been asked to sacrifice in the way of tax increases. And, you know, there is just something deeply unseemly about it. The sons and daughters of the elite do not fight this war, and the elite benefit from the tax cuts. And, you know, Bill is happy about the economy, but read Paul Krugman if you want to have a different view of what the economy is and how this debt that we have mired ourselves in is not something we're growing our way out of, but rather is a tax, a birth tax, on Americans yet unborn into the future.
Bill Kristol, just half a minute before the break here, do these criticisms, do they... Do they cut more as time goes on or less? Do you feel like you've moved further into your agenda and this simply doesn't matter?
No, obviously criticisms matter, and if they're intelligent, they have to be answered and thought through, and one has to adjust policies depending on reality and depending on alternative arguments. I'm not convinced that raising taxes would make our country stronger. I'm certainly convinced that pulling out of Iraq would make our country much weaker. Again, it's a question of what policies we're choosing here, not whether I feel good every day and happy every day when I wake up, because obviously bad things are happening in the world.
Bill Kristol, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking with the editor of the Weekly Standard tonight. You can join us. Conservative listeners, are you still on board with Bill Kristol? Is he singing your tune? Does Bill Kristol describe the world as you know it, the future as you want it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, leading neoconservative thinker. You can join us tonight. What's your question for the country's most prominent neoconservative intellectual? And 4.5 years into the Bush era, what's your assessment of how the neocon experiment is going? Are we safer? Are we headed toward a better world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul is calling from Windale, North Carolina. Hi, Paul. What do you think?
Well, I think that we've certainly made mistakes, but I think Mr. Kristol is essentially right. If we were willing to give up, in a way, war is about oil, control of oil, not stealing it, but selling it on the market. If we're willing to give up every modern convenience we know to man, to Uday and Hussein, who are going to obviously inherit the kingdom down there, I think 14 resolutions at the UN, there was enough. Everybody was for regime change, and now nobody wants to deal with the consequences. This stuff isn't easy. And we are doing a great job, and we are certainly doing a bad job in certain places.
But you say you're on board with Bill Kristol. Bill, how about this? Paul sees himself as a realist and says it's about oil, and that's fine, and I'm glad we did it for that. What do you make of the oil argument?
Well, I think we were buying oil from Saddam, actually, before we toppled him, and I don't know that oil is a very good argument for the war. It's not one I've ever made, frankly, and that's a separate issue of whether we should secure energy, how to secure energy supplies, whether we should try to liberate ourselves more from the Middle East in terms of oil, which I myself would support. So it's not the argument I would particularly make, but I think the caller is right in this sense, and I guess I'd just pick up on the term you used several times, Tom, the neocon experiment or the neoconservative experiment, which does make it sound like a bunch of us intellectuals sit around thinking, oh, let's have a neat experiment with the lives and money of the American people.
No,
and
I don't mean to make light of it.
No, but it is a misleading term because there's no experiment here.
Well, project.
Policy
then,
is about choices. Bill Clinton almost went to war in Iraq in 1998. The notion that we sat around cooking up wars is ridiculous. We, in fact, wrote much less about Iraq before 9/11 than about China, which I thought would be a greater long-term threat and still could be, incidentally. After 9/11, the imperative to change the Middle East seemed to many of us much more urgent, and so, of course, we focused much more on Iraq and on other Saudi Arabia, which we've been extremely critical of in the Weekly Standard. So I'm perfectly happy to defend the policies, but the notion that, it's a policy judgment in the real world, and again, to criticize these policies is fine, but then people have to say what they would do about Iraq or about Saudi Arabia or about whether we should push for democracy in Egypt, even though that could have nasty repercussions, and sort of what their view of American foreign policy should be.
Jack, join us here. Bill Kristol's, I suppose, right, you could look at experiment and say that makes light of it. I certainly don't mean to do that. There's nothing light about it. But as a project, Jack, and beyond the Iraq war, how do you see the neocon impulse playing out?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a part of this neocon project that I think most Americans would agree with, and that is that human rights should be central in our foreign policy, and that national borders should not be impermeable to humanitarian interventions. That no more should we just say, you've got a border, we can't do anything about it, sorry.
We just talked about Srebrenica last night and what happened there 10 years ago.
Right. And so I think there's the moral component of the neoconservative vision, it seems to me, is sound. And it's sound to say that all other things being equal, it would be great for us and for the world if President Bush's vision of democracy were to happen everywhere, if liberation from these tyrannies would happen everywhere, and surely that should be the aim of our policy. But it's a climb down from those worthy goals to connecting that with a war that, I repeat, seems to me, and to people who know a lot more about it than I do, to be a diversion from where our real enemies are and from what our real enemy is.
Are you saying, Jack, there's another way, a policing way, a more targeted way, a way without war? Bill Kristol says, come on, you see what Saddam Hussein dreamed of? How could we let that stand after 9/11?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that we would have been far better off if we had let it stand after 9/11, if we had let the inspectors stay in there instead, as we know they were. The Downing Street memo indicates that we were even squeezing Iraq even before the official invasion. And by the way, you know, on the web now, you can find a Wall Street Journal report from October, I think, 2004, saying that, quoting military people, quoting intelligence people, that Bush could have destroyed Zarqawi's base in Iraq. And indeed, some people hazard Zarqawi himself, but that they didn't want to do that because it would interfere, it would undercut the argument for invading Iraq. Now, there's a case where they put invading Iraq above the war on terror.
We'll hear from Bill Kristol on that. Let me get a call first. Mark is calling from New York City. Mark, what do you think?
Well, I have a simple question. And I should preface this by saying that I could sound off for hours about Bill Kristol's self-satisfaction and smugness and disregard for the lives and circumstances of many Americans and for the country in general. But I have a very simple question, which is, how can you possibly justify a war that was fought under false pretenses?
The missing weapons of mass destruction.
Precisely.
Bill Kristol?
We thought he had those weapons. The world thought he had those weapons. Democrats and Republicans thought he had those weapons. Bill Clinton and Al Gore thought he had those weapons.
But they weren't there.
No, they seem not to have been there.
And we are. Does it change? Does it change your fundamental argument for the war? Or was the WMD argument always a kind of a mask for something else behind?
No, it was a real argument that was part of a broader picture of Saddam Hussein, a man who had invaded a country, used weapons of mass destruction, was under UN sanctions. We were conducting the no-fly zones. This didn't start with George W. Bush. This started with Bill Clinton. We almost went to war in 98. He never satisfied the world that he didn't have the weapons of mass destruction. He chose not to satisfy the world, apparently, because he thought it was important to continue to bluff that he had these weapons to keep himself in power. You know, I'm sorry our intelligence wasn't better. And it does put more of a burden on us, in a sense, now to carry through and succeed in improving the situation in the Middle East, since he seems not to have had these weapons. But I think we acted in good faith. I do not believe that George W. Bush was lying when he said he thought Saddam had these weapons.
And when Paul Wolfowitz says or said there were many reasons, this is just the one we put forward, does that sound like false pretenses to you or just statecraft?
I don't think that's quite what he said, but it was the consensus reason for why did the sanctions exist in the first place? Why was everyone agreed on the sanctions?
Sure, because of the suspicion that those weapons were there.
Right. So it wasn't an invention of ours, and he certainly, and the final inspector's report said, we can't be satisfied, he hasn't fully cooperated. So we thought he had the weapons. He had used weapons of mass destruction.
It sure was front and center, and where are they now? A lot of heads scratched, at the least there. Steve's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Good evening, and Mr. Kristol. Thanks for coming on the air with us.
My pleasure.
I'm calling because I'm a scientist concerned about the national defense, and I'm very concerned about the country's turn toward rejection of rationality and science. And I'm hoping to discuss your take on the neoconservative position on this. And just to give you my sense of that, I know you, for example, went on record in the New Republic this week as being ignorant of evolution, just to take one example since time is short. And your mom wrote a anti-evolutionary book that is used by creationists. And so
that's ludicrous.
Could you provide us some insight on...
Have you read my mother's book, which was written in 1954, Darwin and the Darwinian Revolution?
Yes, I've read it.
Have you read it? Have you ever looked at it?
Yes, I have, sir.
And you don't consider that a serious work of intellectual history?
I consider it a serious work, but I consider it erroneous.
Steve, I think we've got the heart of it. Bill Kristol, if I may, what about, and I've heard this concern voiced from any number of people in the scientific community, that there's a kind of cultural shift away from scientific thinking. How do you look at that?
I think there's a cultural shift away from excessive deference to scientists in drawing conclusions beyond the realm of science. I mean, I have no doubt the Darwinian revolution happened in some way or other. I think I answered the New Republic person honestly by saying I'm not a scientist and I have no view on sort of the details and all of that. My kids went to public schools here in Virginia and I got that standard scientific instruction. It didn't bother me one way or the other. I don't think we're turning away from science. I don't think there's a huge anti-intellectual or anti-enlightenment movement in this country. Scientists don't like to have any of their, don't like to be questioned when people say, well, wait a second, are you drawing all the conclusions you're drawing from some scientific facts or scientific theories correct? So I'm not too worried about it.
So the neocon, theocon...
And I really resent, I will say this, I mean, my mother wrote a serious book about Darwin and his reception in England. I think it was very well reviewed. It was not considered a conservative book particularly. It was written, as I say, I believe in 1954 or something like that, when I was a very, very, very little kid. And the notion that, you know, everyone who says anything at all heterodox about the history of science now is going to be called anti-evolutionary or somehow a tool of creationists is really disturbing, I think.
But as a pragmatist, you're not worried about national wealth, the national security being dented by the rise in skepticism about evolution and scientific endeavor in general?
No, I don't think there's a skepticism. There seems to be an awful lot of people are doing an awful lot of science in this country. I don't know that there's much skepticism about science. No, this is not a major concern of mine.
Jack, we just got a couple of minutes left here. Bill Kristol still swinging a pretty big bat in Washington and saying that's just the road he's going to stay on. And it's not easy, but it's the right thing to do, and it's perhaps painfully slowly headed in the right direction. Do you have any doubt that that's the road we will stay on?
Oh, I guess I think it is the road we will stay on, and I just hope it isn't in this time frame that that Don Rumsfeld was talking about, 2010, 2012, because this, if it is, there have been projections of what U.S. casualties would be, and it's upwards of 5,000 dead and 25,000 injured, and as I said before in this program, 100,000 psychiatric casualties. That's not a price I want those people to have to pay.
Bill Kristol, is there a point, back to Winston Churchill, just half a minute here, but victory at all costs. Is there a point at which costs become too high or out of whack with even your vision of what this effort may buy us?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, in the real world, I suppose there are times one might have to say that a just war is too costly and we're not going to fight it anymore, or that I suppose even that we're going to surrender to terrorists. It's a horrible thought, though, and I think we're nowhere close to that. I mean, this is a war. Look, when we planned this war, when the government planned this war, they expected the weapons of mass destruction could be used. They expected there could be 5,000 casualties.
Right off the bat.
The Senate voted for this war expecting that there could well be 5,000 or 10,000 deaths, not just casualties, in Iraq.
And so we're shy of that, but a long, long road ahead. Bill Kristol, always fascinating to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard. And Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, Bill Clinton speaks on the future of the Democratic Party. This is On Point. As his wife continues to make headlines as the Democrats' potential presidential frontrunner for 2008, former President Bill Clinton is speaking out about the Democratic Party's best strategy for moving forward. Last week at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado, Clinton encouraged his fellow Democrats to broaden their base. Throughout this week, we'll be bringing you excerpts from some of the notable speeches in Aspen. Here is Bill Clinton with his suggestions for the Democratic Party.
At my library dedication, the last song was sung by a woman who's been a friend of mine for almost 30 years, she and her husband. He is the pastor of the largest Pentecostal church in Louisiana. Now, you wouldn't expect the Pentecostals to be my political base, but he's one of the best friends I've got, and I love her like a sister. So after it was over, we're all soft and wet up in the apartment. He comes up to me and he says, I got a confession to make to you. I said, what is it? I said, no, first I said, this is great. I got a preacher confessing to me. No one. Here I am, the world's most famous sinner. I've got a preacher confessing to me. And I said, I said, what is it, Anthony? He said, I voted for Bush. I said, do you think he was a good president? He said, well, I don't know. He said, you know, I got mixed feelings about Iraq. And he said, I hate all these tax cuts for rich people like you. I don't like deficits. He said, I was furious when they cut out these after-school programs. And he had a very sophisticated understanding. I said, did you vote for him over the social issues? He said, no. He said, you know, I'm a Pentecostal. I'm anti-gay marriage and pro-life. But he said, I'm also the only Southern Pentecostal preacher that ever endorsed the Employment Non-Discrimination Act against gays. I said, from the pulpit, I said, how come you to do that? He smiled. He said, because I know you. He said, you've been talking to me about this for 20 years, and finally I came to see that all these people are God's children, and they have a right to make a living. And it's just wrong to discriminate against them. I said, well, why did you vote for him? He said, I voted for you twice. He said, I love Hillary, but he said, I voted for President Bush because ever since you left, nobody in your party talks to us anymore.
Yep. He said,
you know, you don't have to get us all. He said, you ain't going to get Robertson, Falwell, James Dobson. He said, you shouldn't get those people. They're really not for you. They don't like you and they don't agree with you. But he said, most of us are just trying to hold our families and our congregations and our communities together in a hostile culture. We're trying to make sense of a life we don't understand. We got people losing jobs and kids on drugs. We've got all the problems the country does. And we're trying to have a moral core here. We're trying to make sense. So anyway, I went back and checked the figures. And among white evangelical Christians in 1996, Bob Dole beat me 63-37. Pretty good whipping, right? President Bush beat Al Gore 74-26. He defeated John Kerry 78-21. And it wasn't because John Kerry had substantially different positions than me. Because Mangan said to me, this preacher said, I never asked you to change your position on gay rights or abortion. He said, but I never thought you disrespected mine. I thought at the core we cared about the same things. And he said, you can't win if you don't talk to us. There's too many of us out here. And it was brilliant, you know, just brilliant. So my advice is get on a bus and go to rural Ohio. Don't give up on Kentucky, West Virginia, Louisiana, rural Arkansas, all these places, you know. America's not all that different. Barack Obama's speech at the Democratic Convention was right. There's a little red and all blue people and a little blue and all red people.
Former President Bill Clinton speaking at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. Special thanks to KAJX in Aspen. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.